from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Some diplomatic progress has been made during the four-way talks in Berlin between Russia, Ukraine, France, and Germany over the situation in eastern Ukraine. An agreement was reached on establishing security buffer zones between rebel positions and those held by Kiev government forces. We have this report from CCTV.
A demarcation line for East Ukraine. That was the consensus of a meeting between four ministers from Russia, Ukraine, France, and Germany on Wednesday.
Today there has finally been an agreement on the demarcation line, as stated and marked in the Minsk agreement. It will be the line that defends areas where heavy weaponry must be withdrawn. We have agreed on the line and on further procedures.
It's hoped that the demarcation line, if it goes ahead, will release the people of East Ukraine from the fear of endless shelling. But in sharp contrast to the apparent breakthrough, the clashes and the blame games are heating up. Fighting between rebels and Ukrainian forces continued on Wednesday, claiming at least two civilian lives in Donetsk and leaving many homeless right in the depth of winter.
When I heard a second missile approaching, I immediately closed the door. It hit a neighboring bread shop and part of mine. I crouched down and part of the shrapnel came over my head and look, the menu fell down.
Meanwhile, the Ukraine government has claimed that its forces came under direct attack from Russian regular forces. The prolonged conflict in Ukraine's east has so far claimed nearly 5,000 lives. One thing that all sides in the region want is an end to the violence. Russia says it wants an immediate ceasefire. The Ukrainian president says he will sign another ceasefire deal at any minute. But the fighting goes on for now, with both sides apparently engaged in making as many small gains as they can before the guns fall silent.
A discussion at the UN Security Council Wednesday wasn't quite as fruitful as the Berlin talks. We'll have more on that later in this newscast. China has announced it's going to build a $242 billion high-speed rail link between Beijing and Moscow. The line would cut trip time between the two BRICS country capitals from 5 days to 25 hours. The railway will be 4,350 miles long and transit through Kazakhstan. China is actively promoting its high-speed railway technology and sees Russia as an especially attractive market due to its strained relations with Western countries over Ukraine. The announcement placed this major transport project on a list of major-scale projects around the world, including a transoceanic canal in Nicaragua and a transcontinental railroad in South America, being built by China. An agreement between rebels and the Yemeni government has resulted in the reopening of the port city of Aden as tensions appear to be cooling off. We have this report from Press TV.
Air and seaports have resumed activity in the Yemeni city of Aden a day after the president struck an agreement with Ansarullah fighters to end tensions in the country. On Wednesday, security authorities had closed all crossings into the southern port city after days of clashes between the Houthi and Ansarullah fighters and government forces in the capital, Sana'a. Now, officials say there is no need to continue the closure as security concerns are over after the deal. According to the new agreement, Ansarullah fighters will pull out from the presidential compound. The deal also includes a clause that would answer their demands to amend the constitution and expand their role in parliament and state institutions.
The Houthi fighters, also known as Ansarullah, have taken full control of the presidential palace in Sana'a. This came after fierce clashes at the compound with presidential guards. Ansarullah's leader has said the move was necessary in order to pressure President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi to meet the demands of the Yemeni people and to counter what he called foreign conspiracies aimed at dividing Yemen.
There was no other options available but for the Yemeni people to make a move and counter these foreign plots. It is the Yemeni people's right to counter these plots because such plots are targeting their security and stability and their economy and also their independence and country's sovereignty. These conspiracies is also targeting the people's future. There was no other choices but to stand firm in front of these schemes.
In the midst of the Houthis' rise to power, Yemeni politicians have accused Abdelmalek al-Houthi of coordinating a military coup against Hadi's regime. Ansarullah's political office in Sana'a has, however, rejected the claims and insists they are moving in accordance with the Peace and National Partnership Agreement signed back in September.
The Houthi leader's speech yesterday was very clear. He gave reassurance to beneficial foreign projects in Yemen and gave reassurance to political factions of the country when he said that we are not against any political party or any entity in the country. The speech of the Houthi leader indicated that there are no intentions to try and execute what they're calling a military coup.
Tensions between the Yemeni government and Ansarullah mounted after the Houthis detained President Hadi's chief of staff, Ahmed Uwad bin Mubarak, who was also the president of Yemen's National Dialogue Conference. The Houthi movement accuses Hadi and his chief of staff of violating the peace and national partnership deal, which Houthis believe is the only way forward for Yemen.
Yusuf Maudi, Press TV, Sana'a.
On a personal note, I've seen a lot in my time as Attorney General, but few things have affected me as greatly as my visit to Ferguson. I had the chance to meet with the family of Michael Brown. I spoke to them not just as Attorney General, but as a father. I wanted the people of Ferguson to know that I personally stood that mistrust. I wanted them to know that while so much else may be uncertain, this Attorney General and this Department of Justice stands with the people of Ferguson. My commitment to them is that long after this tragic story no longer receives this level of attention, the Justice Department will continue to stand with Ferguson.
That was the U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder last August commenting on the case surrounding the killing of unarmed 18-year-old Michael Brown by Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson. But apparently, although the story is far from fading into the background, his department's interest in the case is. According to a report in the New York Times, Justice Department lawyers will recommend that no civil rights charges be brought against the police officer after an FBI investigation found no evidence to support charges. Holder and his civil rights chief, Vanity Gupta, will have the final say on whether the department will close the case, but according to the Times, it would be unusual for them to overrule their prosecutors on the case, who are still working on a law memo explaining their recommendation. As the docudrama Selma makes the rounds of theaters across the U.S., the debate over the film's historical accuracy continues. Black Agenda Report's Glenn Ford offered this commentary on that subject.
Like all historical dramatic films, Selma is a political work, reflecting the political views of the producers. Oprah Winfrey is one of those producers, in addition to playing one of the characters in this version of the Selma story. Her handwriting, that is, her conservative black political worldview, is all over the film, which demands and deserves a political response. For the purposes of this brief radio commentary, I'm only going to register three complaints. Number one, the film is a crude insult to SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee workers who, along with a small minority of black preachers like Dr. Martin Luther King, comprise the infrastructure of the civil rights movement in the Deep South. These hundreds of heroic young people who've been organizing communities in Mississippi and Georgia and, yes, Lowndes County, Alabama, for years, and who invited Dr. King to come to Selma, are personified in the film by one confused-sounding, infantile-behaving youth who we are supposed to believe is James Foreman, the SNCC executive secretary, who was, in real life, a Korean War veteran and former teacher and groundbreaking organizer about the same age as Dr. King. In the film, the James Foreman character comes across as petty-minded, while Dr. King is made to seem like the only adult in town. Veterans of SNCC have a right to be hurt at being consigned to the dustbin of history by the likes of Oprah Winfrey. The rest of us should also be angry at having our history treated like a Saturday morning cartoon. Some people are missing from the film that absolutely should be in there. No, I'm not talking about Stokely Carmichael, although, yes, he is quite relevant to the story. I mean the Kennedy brothers, John and Bobby, who were the ones who authorized the bugging of Dr. King's phones and office and hotel rooms. But Oprah loves the Kennedys, and so the movie leads the audience to believe that J. Edgar Hoover and President Lyndon Johnson set out to surveil and destroy King because of his push for voting rights. But Attorney General Robert Kennedy signed the order, while his brother, who was then president, was still alive. Oprah insults black SNCC civil rights heroes, but she protects the white, rich Kennedys. Finally, near the end of the film, Dr. King is depicted as yearning for an end to mass protests so that black people could achieve real political power, quite clearly meaning the election of more black people to office. As if that's what the mass movement was all about in King's mind. We know that's not true, because Dr. King said the opposite in countless sermons, speeches, books, and essays, that he was seeking social transformation, a new system of living. 3 years after Selma, King died, still seeking to revive the mass movement. For Oprah Winfrey, Dr. King was just an opening act for a future President Obama and for an age of billionaire black TV celebrities. As Professor Abdul Al-Kalamat of the University of Illinois has written about the film Selma, if the most militant person in the movie is played by Oprah, you know something is very, very wrong. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Thursday marked the 42nd anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in the case titled Roe v. Wade, ruling that the right of women to terminate a pregnancy during the first two trimesters was a protected part of the constitutional right to privacy. In the years since, the issue of abortion has been a defining one between the two major political parties, and the new Congress, with Republicans in control of both houses for the first time in 8 years, is already seeing the battle lines drawn yet again. On the day of this year's Roe v. Wade anniversary, the House voted 242 to 179 to approve the Republican-sponsored H.R. 7, the so-called No Taxpayer Funding for Abortion and Abortion Insurance Full Disclosure Act of 2015. Although the House passed the same bill last year, it failed to pass the democratically controlled Senate. With this year's Republican majority there, the bill's chances are seen as better, but still difficult, as a number of Republicans have been reluctant to sign on. President Obama issued a veto threat against last year's bill and is widely expected to veto this one should it clear the Senate. The bill adopted by the House was reintroduced this year after a planned bill to ban most abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy faced a revolt by Republican women, making passage of that version unlikely. At least one member of the House stood up to the majority, Democrat Marcia Fudge from Ohio.
Mr. Speaker, this must be Groundhog Day, because this House continues to revisit over and over again a woman's right to make decisions about her own health. Roe v. Wade has long established a woman's constitutional right to have an abortion prior to a fetus's viability. Yet Republicans continue to introduce legislation to ban abortions beginning at 20 weeks with very limited exceptions. In Congress and in several states, politicians are interfering in complicated private medical decisions that should be left to a woman, her family, and her doctor. That is why I am proud to co-introduce the Women's Health Protection Act, a bill making it unlawful for states to pass restrictive legislation that will endanger women's health and safety. Women's reproductive rights must be respected.
The latest escalation of fighting in Ukraine has caught the attention of the UN Security Council, which met Wednesday, with the U.S. delegation double-teaming Russia's permanent representative Vitaly Churkin. The first round of accusations against Russia came from the U.S. permanent representative Samantha Power.
Well, this is the Council's first session on Ukraine in 2015. It is our 28th meeting on the crisis in the last 11 months, far more than on any other situation during the same period. We keep meeting on Ukraine because, despite countless commitments made to the international community to de-escalate, here in the Council, at Geneva, Minsk, Berlin, Normandy, and elsewhere, Russia continues to choose the path of escalation and obfuscation. In addition to occupying Crimea, Russia continues to train, equip, and fight alongside separatists in eastern Ukraine. Indeed, Russia has so consistently broken its commitments and violated its obligations not to lop off part of another country that some here may begin to accept Russia's behavior as an unfortunate but inevitable reality, a new normal that would be dangerous for Ukraine and dangerous for international peace and security, because complacency would reward aggression and threaten the basic rules on which our collective security rests.
Churkin responded coolly to Power's allegations.
Thank you, Mr. President. In this chamber, the Security Council conducts a large number of meetings on a number of worthwhile topics. We use a lot of beautiful words about the need to peacefully settle crises, that there's no military solution, about the rule of law, democracy, and the inclusiveness of political processes, on human rights and the priority of the protection of civilians in a conflict. However, after about 30 times of discussing Ukraine here, the question arises, how much are these declarations in line with the situation in the country? Do they have a direct application, or are they given just for eloquence's sake, but can be thrown aside when political suitability takes precedence? Are all of these resolutions and PRSTs adopted by the country in question, Ukraine? Sir, the Russian Federation is ensuring a full compliance with the Minsk Agreement to settle the Ukrainian crisis. We are in contact with sides, the leadership of Ukraine, and as well as the rebels, and representatives of interested foreign countries, including in the Normandy format. Unfortunately, 16 January's meeting of the Minsk Contact Group was botched by Kiev. The representatives of Ukraine didn't appear in the Belarusian capital. The situation on the ground recently has significantly worsened. The epicenter of clashes has become the Donetsk airport, in spite of the fact that in line with the Minsk agreements, the airport was supposed to be given to the rebels. This matter was not resolved peacefully due to disputes on other areas of the engagement line. The Ukrainian armed forces continued to shell from these areas, Donetsk and other inhabited areas, which led to a large number of civilian casualties. On 15 January, the President of Russia sent to the President of Ukraine a missive regarding the need to swiftly implement the silence regime, as well as the need for a swift withdrawal of weapons from the engagement line in line with the Minsk agreements, based on coordinates which were insisted upon by the Ukrainian side, and I stress that, as well as a timetable which was provided regarding the withdrawal time frame for all different types of weaponry, including conventional and reactive artillery. And this was again set forth by the Ukrainian side. The Russian side expressed its readiness to bring every influence to bear on rebels to ensure that this option was adopted and complied with, as well as that we would provide assistance to the OSCE regarding monitoring of the implementation of these steps. And I underscore, this letter was sent with a request for telephone contact between Russia and Ukraine. However, instead of appropriately responding to the proposal, the Ukrainian side resumed artillery shelling of Donetsk. Mr. President, the current escalation of the situation in Donbass is hardly fortuitous. Over the whole ceasefire time, the Ukrainian side violated the Minsk agreements in stepping up its military presence in the southeast of the country. There was a strengthening of the militarization and regrouping, as well as new waves of mobilization from Kiev. There were appeals to avenge the defeat of 2014. At the same time, a number of countries actively supporting the war party in Kiev irresponsibly provided Ukraine with military purpose items. It is clear that the events of the past days are yet another attempt by Kiev to resolve the internal political conflict militarily, which will definitely bring about an exacerbation of the crisis of the Ukrainian state and several civilian casualties. Finally, this is fraught with catastrophe. Sir, we've many times in this chamber pointed to the fact that those who came to power as a result of a state coup d'etat, the so-called government of the victors, enjoying support from armed radicals, are conducting a policy which has nothing in common with establishing a country of national unity. Kiev has cast aside all documents for a political settlement of the internal crisis. The agreement from 21 February, signed by Yanukovych and the opposition, regarding the establishment of a government of national unity, was dead letter the next day. The Geneva Statement from 17 April, planning for a swift conducting of comprehensive consultation reform with all regions and political forces, was ignored. The OSCE roadmap, rejected. Has anyone here heard anything about the inclusive nationwide dialogue, which is planned for in the Minsk Protocol? First thing done by the new government and Kiev was pushing forward decisions aiming to limit the rights of linguistic minorities and suffocating dissidents. The fact that half of the country speaks Russian led to the fact that almost all Russian-speaking media was cut off, as well as Russian TV channels. There was intimidation or outright prohibition of political forces representing the political the Russian citizens in Ukraine and the southeast of the country. The southeast and south saw horrific crimes committed, which have not yet been brought to light or even seriously investigated. On the 2nd of May in Odessa, some people were burned alive in the Union House in Mariupol on 9 May, the victory day of the Great Patriotic War. Civilians were shot, and in July, in Lugansk, there were airstrikes. Mr. President, the essence and trend of the crisis in Ukraine is difficult to understand without understanding the ideological undercurrent. Last year, the state holiday in Ukraine was declared 14 October, the day of the establishment of the Ukrainian rebel army, warring on the side of the Nazis. This is where the consecration of Ukrainian collaborators with the Nazis and human-hating individuals, Bandera and Shushkevich, came from, leading to the deaths of dozens of thousands of Ukrainian Soviets and Poles. I would just note a quote from Bandera. I would kill any Pole from 16 to 60 years old of age. And I would quote Shushkevich as well. Not intimidate, but wipe out. Fear not that citizens will damn us for our violence. If only half of the 40 million population of Ukraine remains, there's nothing wrong with that. Now there are explosive marches a la Waffen-SS with portraits of the so-called heroes of Ukraine. These are conducted absolutely openly with the approval of the Kiev powers. God be with the country. The Ukrainian people deserve better heroes. The people of the east of Ukraine see this as if in America, the day of the establishment of the Ku Klux Klan was called a national holiday, and its members marched in Washington with burning crosses and created militia so as to instate order in the country. The Prime Minister, Yatsenyuk, on the German television lamented the fact that in the Second World War, the USSR conducted incursions into Ukraine and Germany. It would seem that he would like Ukraine to still be under Nazi occupation today. However, enlightened Europe had nothing to say on this matter. It's very strange that those who claim to be civilized could deal with such an ideological digression. These are the ideological ideas guiding Kiev during its anti-terrorist operation, which is actually a punitive one. Against the cities in the southeast, there's aviation, heavy weaponry, artillery, the prohibited cluster and phosphor bombs, tactical rockets, and volley fire systems. The confirmed number of victims is reaching 5,000 rebels and IDPs, millions. Just in the city of Donetsk, there are more than 1,000 houses destroyed. Many small inhabited areas have been totally destroyed. There are strikes on residential areas and infrastructure with total disregard for international law. Mr. President, the Minsk agreement signed in September by Kiev and the representatives of Lugansk and Donetsk with the mediation of the OSCE and Russia provided a basis for a peaceful solution. There's a need for a swift resumption of practical work with the contact group for their full implementation. For our part, we're doing our utmost to ensure that the next meeting in Minsk would take place as quickly as possible. We would urge all conscientious members of the international community to require from the Ukrainian government a halt of the mentality of confrontation and an unconditional stopping of the forceful quashing of the Southeast, and to tell them that the most pressing need now is a launching of Ukrainian-wide dialogue for a substantive discussion of the constitutional makeup of the country, which would be favorable and safe for all citizens. Thank you.
Later in the session, Powers' senior deputy for political affairs, David Pressman, took another go at Ambassador Churkin.
I certainly understand the desire of the representative of the Russian Federation to speak about other conflicts and other crises rather than the situation and their tactics of continuing to support the separatists who are wreaking havoc in Ukraine. It seems that while Russia continues the same tactics of supporting the separatists in Ukraine, it also continues its same tactics in this council, distracting, demonstrating a repeated preference for fantasy over fact. So let's be clear. It has been claimed that the Russian Federation is striving for implementation of the Minsk agreements. In fact, Russia and the separatists it supports have taken practically no steps to implement the September Minsk agreements. For example, attacks are continuing past the agreed ceasefire line. Weapons, heavy artillery, and military personnel continue to flow across the border from Russia to the separatists. The border remains unsecured, and hostages are still being held, including on Russian territory. Meanwhile, Ukraine has taken great strides to implement the provisions of the September 5th Minsk Protocol, including twice declaring a unilateral ceasefire as separatist attacks continued. It has been claimed that Ukraine is building up its military presence and resorting to militarization. In fact, Ukraine is attempting to hold the ceasefire line agreed to on September 19th, that the Russian-backed separatists have decided to ignore the line and try to take additional territory does not provide a basis to renegotiate that line. The line should not be renegotiated because the separatists have gained additional territory through repeated ceasefire violations since September. It has been claimed that the Donetsk airport under Minsk should be under the control of the Russian-backed separatists. In fact, according to the September 19th Minsk agreement, the line of contact should go straight through the Donetsk airport, and the agreement stipulated that all forces would draw back at least 15 kilometers on both sides of the ceasefire line. The airport should have remained neutral territory had the Minsk agreements been properly implemented. The September 19th agreement laid out specific coordinates. There should be no confusion that can't be solved with a GPS. The representative of the Russian Federation claims that Ukraine will not respond to President Putin's latest proposal. In fact, there is no need to renegotiate a new peace plan or a new ceasefire line. The September Minsk agreements, which provide for a cessation of fighting, permanent international monitoring of the border, the removal of all Russian equipment and personnel from the Ukrainian territory, the release of all hostages, and increased autonomy for the region within Ukrainian law remain the best path to de-escalating this conflict. What the Russians seem to be doing is not to implement Minsk, but to redraft the line of control articulated in it. Russia and the separatists it supports should fulfill its commitments made in September rather than attempting to reopen negotiations while increasing the level of violence and attacks to change the facts on the ground. We need more facts, less fantasy. We need more implementation of Minsk, not more distractions from it. Thank you.
Churkin was quick to reply.
Mr. President, it seems that the DPR of Madam Power thinks that she's not eloquent enough in setting out the American position, and so he just repeated some provisions from the statement. And I do regret that Ambassador Power hasn't decided to continue this principal discussion with us on matters of international policy. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.